بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم كن لوليك حجة ابن الحسن صلواتك عليه وعلى آبائه في هذه الساعة وفي كل ساعة وليا وحافظا وقائدا وناصرا تسكنه أرضك طوعا وتمتعه فيها طويلا.
صلوا على محمد وآل محمد. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ولتكن منكم أمة يدعون إلى الخير ويأمرون بالمعروف وينهون عن المنكر وأولئك هم المفلحون. ولا تكونوا كالذين تفرقوا واختلفوا من بعد ما جاء وأولئك لهم عذاب عظيم. يوم تبيض وجوه وتسود وجوه فأما الذين اسودت وجوههم فذوقوا العذاب بما كنتم تكفرون. وأما الذين ابيضت وجوههم ففي رحمة الله هم فيها خالدون. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
صلوا على محمد وعلى محمد. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين. Brothers and sisters and respected speakers, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Once again, on behalf of the MSA PSG, we would like to welcome you to our 42nd annual seminar. As most of you know, in 1979, only 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, under the uncompromising leadership of Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah Ta'ala Alayhi, millions came to the ballot box and the first magnificent public opinion poll was conducted by the guidance of Imam. Over 98% voted for the establishment of the Islamic Republic. Within a single year, people took part in 5 elections. In the next 23 years that succeeded the Islamic Revolution, people participated in 23 different times for the elections of the members of the Majlis, which is the parliament, the constitution, the election of the assembly of experts, electing members of the Islamic City Council, and elections of the presidents. And yet, the mainstream mass media, also known as the Zionist propaganda machine, accuses the Islamic Republic of aristocracy and lack of democracy. After the revolution of the Islamic After the Islamic victory of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Ta'ala Alayhi, through his teachings and guidance, constructed a consolidated Islamic framework that were neither connected to the Eastern socialism nor to Western liberalism. We all remember the slogans like, no East, no West, only Islam, Istiqlal Azadi Jamhuriya Islami, which is independence, freedom, Islamic Republic. This afternoon we're going to have a panel discussion on Vilayat-e-Faqih and democracy. But before we start our panel discussion, I would like to invite Brother Mark Glenn to please come to the podium and introduce Dr. Tulavi, because he'll be our first speaker. And without any further delay, I ask Brother Mark to come to the podium. Takbir. Allah.
Those of you who were brave enough to come up and shake my hand knowing that I had the plague, after my speech, asked for a business card. And if you happen to read the business card, you would see at the top, Crescent and Cross Solidarity Movement. And you are thinking to yourself, well, I know he's a Christian, so I guess that's where the cross came from, but where's the crescent? Well, the crescent is with us today. In fact, I cannot even take credit for the title of this little thing. Those of you who see me on press TV, they always talk about me being with the Crescent and Cross Solidarity Movement. And I have to give credit where credit is due in introducing the speaker who came up with the title. It was our idea, but he came up with the title. He's very good with titles and slogans and things like that. I met him, I guess it's been about 8 years now. 8 years ago, I saw that he had a television program. And the things that he was saying on his television program about Muslims and Christians, sorry, I told you I'm from Idaho, about Muslims and Christians coming together in solidarity against a common enemy, I said, now that sounds good. That's the kind of guy that I need to work with. And so I contacted him, and within just a few minutes, we realized that we were like twins who had been separated from birth and raised in different religions. Since that time, he has been like a brother to me, an older brother. So in introducing our next speaker, let me just give a little bit of biographical information on him. He is the Secretary General of the Jerusalem Conference and Shidu al-Rihal. Did I say it right? Okay, he made sure to grab my ear and say, now make sure you say this right when you get up there. And I did then, but I didn't know if I would know. He is also the three-time president of the Lafayette Islamic Center in Lafayette, Louisiana. And he is the producer and host of Current Issues television and radio program. You can find the television program by going to currentissues.tv. And he's one of the brightest lights that we have out here in terms of being able to analyze exactly what is going on. And so, having said that, without further ado, please give a nice round of applause to Dr. Hisham Talawi. Dr. Talawi.
Thank you, Mark. We should have had the dinner in this room, actually. We had a full room next door, but they probably all went to sleep after they had dinner. I'm glad to see that all of you have made it through today, December 21st, 2012, the day that the world was supposed to be over with. The day is not over yet, so we will see what's going to happen. When I was invited to attend the conference, I said, what can I talk about? What can a possibly Sunni talk to a bunch of Shiites about? You know, we supposedly supposed to not like each other. And so I had prepared the speech, actually, to deliver. And then this morning, I was reading the schedule for the conference, and it said I was going to be speaking about the Islamic identity in the West. So I said, okay. So I had prepared a huge speech. So now what I'm going to do, actually, is probably condense my speech to talk about both topics, the Islam in the West, and at the same time, my prepared speech about how we and why we got to where we are today. I was really hoping to see more younger people in the audience, but if we can show just a show of hands to how many American citizens do we have, I would appreciate it. Just raise your hand if you are an American citizen, okay? And I'm assuming that since we are all American citizens, we probably identify ourselves as Muslim Americans, probably. If you identify yourself as Muslim American, raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Some of them going like that, don't know what that means. What about American Muslims? How many identify yourself as American Muslims? Nobody. You're probably wondering, is he playing tricks with us? What's the difference? Muslim-American or American-Muslim? Well, no, it's just English language happened to be a funny language, and we like Muslim-Americans, Muslim-Americans, better, because we hear about Muslim-Americans associations, Muslim-Americans, and in the media, they refer to us as Muslim-Americans, and you know, if you know anything about adjectives and nouns, you know, I would prefer to be a noun than an adjective describing something. And Muslim American happens to be an adjective here that is describing some Americans who are Muslims, and since the media describe us that way, It's supposed to be something to be worried about. You know, it's like, I'm Muslim American. You know, I don't want anyone to know, but I'm Muslim American. No, actually, I like to go with American Muslim. I like to be the noun because we are, if you really think about it, we are Muslims, and that's how we want people to look at us in the United States. The United States, I don't know what's an American. I really don't. You know, if you do, maybe after the lecture, you can tell me. But this is a country that happened to, it's a new country, probably a couple of hundred years old. And people, when you come here and you decided to make this home and you decided to raise children in this country and they became Americans, then this country is yours. But Muslims, somehow, we hate Shaitan al-Akbar, the big, you know, the great Satan. Well, that's fine, hate the great Satan, but this land is your land and you need to act as you are an American Muslim, not Muslim Americans as the media likes to describe you, which is basically, when they say Muslim Americans, basically might as well just have a big sign that says terrorist here. And so we need to start acting as Americans, not as this is the country we hate, because believe it or not, your children don't look at this country the way you do or the way you did, and their children are not going to look at this country the way your children look at this country. And only if we start thinking as this country does not belong to the Zionists, you know, why are we letting it? It's like we gave up, we hate you, and you can have it. No. If you're going to live in the United States and your nationality is an American, then you need to be an American Muslim, not a Muslim American. And I hope all of you got the idea behind, because our identity, it doesn't matter where, if it's in the United States or if it's in Europe, it's like we don't belong. Well, we want to make sure that we think that yes, we do belong. That this whole land, if we learned anything about Islam, that this whole land is our land. The whole earth is our land. So it doesn't matter where you are on this earth, that is your land. And if it happens to be your political identity or nationality happens to be one of those political nationalities around the world, then work as, number one, you are a Muslim. Now, to me, Muslim and Islam is not just to pray and fast and do the Hajj. No, it's a lot more than that. It's a way of life. It's how we live our life. Then the ibadat part of it is very small. Really, the ibadat is very, very small. 99% of the times, we don't spend our time in worshiping. We spend our time in living within these societies. And Islam did not spread by some Muslims going to some country and saying, we hate you and we're different than you. No, it spread when they went there, they mingled within the society, and before you know it, that whole country became a Muslim country. Now, my speech that I prepared actually has a lot to do with what is going on in the world. That's where my expertise is, and that's what I have been working on probably for the last 15 years. Back in 1996, two things happened in a little village in the Middle East called Qatar. If I offend any one of you by saying village, I apologize. Now, in Qatar, there's two things that took place in the same year. One of them was Al Jazeera, and I'm sure most of you probably heard of it. In the same year, there was something else that was established there, which is the largest United States Air Force base in the world. Now, keep in mind the year, 96. This was way before 9/11. So Al Jazeera was established, and the largest Air Force base in the world outside the continental United States. What Al Jazeera did is it spent 10 years of doing something that was supposedly new to the Middle East and to the Arab countries, where basically they were talking about subjects that normally the government-run TVs and media don't talk about. So people kind of went, and with billions of dollars, Al Jazeera and the Qatari government spent billions of dollars for many, many years with bureaus around the world that topped CNN and Fox in spending. They have captured the Arab mind. So everything Al Jazeera did, it was like if it was Munzil or something from the Quran. No one actually questioned what Al Jazeera did. What Al Jazeera had done in 10 years, it went and it found every diversity in the Arab world and brought it up to the surface and started talking about it. It brought up the Shiites and the Sunnis, and they will get a Shia and a Sunni, and they will go at it. For many years, they have done that. And then they did with the Kurds and the Arabs, and they did that with the Christians and the Muslims, and they did that with the Copts. And they have not, I mean, the Arab world, the way it was structured for the last 100 years, it was made up of different people. And these countries, the way they were formed, I'm sure most of you know about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, where they just basically took a pencil after the defeat of the Ottoman Empire after the First World War, and they made circles. This is here Iraq, this is Syria, this is Jordan, this is this, and this is that. And they installed governments that they wanted in those, and still have some of these governments are still in control now. Now, Al Jazeera, after it had captured the minds of the Arab people, we go back to before Al Jazeera was born. Back in 1982, there was a document published in Beirut, Lebanon, by the Arab University Graduates Association. It's called The Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. Now what that document said, it took every Arab country. And it said at first they said, we cannot destroy our enemy, the Arabs as whole, by military means. Sure, they can go up there with their fighters and destroy every Arab capital, and there's nothing the Arabs can do about, but you're not destroying them, but you have to destroy them from within. And in this document, they said, and they named every Arab country, and they said, in Iraq, the fault lines underneath that society, you have Kurds and Arabs, and you have Sunnis and Shiites. And they said, by removing the Saddam Hussein regime, you will start the dominoes effect of that particular formula. And they took Egypt and said, we do this. And they took Syria and they said, we do this. And Lebanon and every Arab country. And this is not a secret document. As a matter of fact, it has been out there since 1982, but we do not read. What is happening right now is the implementation of that document exactly. Now, in 1996, as I mentioned before, Al Jazeera was created and the largest Air Force base. But something else also was back in 1996, something that is called Clean Break, securing the realm for Israel. What that document says and who wrote it. The people who wrote these documents are mainly, I'm going to mention a couple of names for you. You probably have heard these names before: Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, and many others that you became later on. We did not know them back then in 1996, but we knew them when George Bush actually became president. They were in the George Bush administration to actually make policies and make decisions on who goes to war and when and what country that we are going to destroy. That was back in 1996, and in 1996, in this document that I'm talking about, they said that the removal of Saddam Hussein from power is an Israeli objective in its own right. They wrote that back in 1996. 2001 came around, and we all know what happened in 2001. On September 12th, which is one day after September 11th, George Tenet, the CIA director, was going into the White House to brief the president on what took place the day before, which is the Twin Tower destruction. George Tenet going in, coming out of the Oval Office was Richard Pearl. And Richard Pearl looks at George Tenet and he goes, Iraq must pay for this. Now George Tenet looked around and he goes, what is he talking about? Now remember, George Tenet is the CIA director. And on September 12th, he said he really did not have much to go on, and he was going to brief the president about what he has, and all of a sudden you have Richard Pearl coming in and saying, Iraq must pay for this. Now remember, Iraq spent 12 years under economic embargo. We all know that 500,000 Iraqis died, lost their lives, due to lack of food, and lack of medicine and malnutrition. Somehow, Richard Pearl convinced the president that we need to go and attack Iraq. Well, there's another document that came up back in 2000, written by the same people that we came to know as the neocons. Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, again, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, Douglas Feith. Douglas Feith is an Israeli. He's an Israeli who was an attorney in Israel, and he had his practice there in Israel. And all of a sudden, he became the director of the Office of Special Plans at the Pentagon. He's the one that came up with the story about the mass, the uranium, the yellow cake from Niger, and the story started going out there where everybody thought that, yes, Saddam Hussein, he's going to actually come to the United States and destroy it. This is the what they basically told the American people. And the American people, as most of you know, that they will listen to the media because they don't know any better. So they started the hatred around these people in Iraq who basically could not feed their children, that somehow they are going to come to the United States and kill people here in the United States. Give it 2 or 3 months after that, the United States was talking about going to war against Iraq, and they did, and they went to war against Iraq, and we all know what happened after that. Then somehow we had Condoleezza Rice going there after the destruction of Iraq, and she talked about the new Middle East. Which is, by the way, it was a term that was used also in the document, the Clean Break document that we talked about earlier, the New Middle East. Now if you look at the Middle East, the people of the Middle East, and I was shocked. I was really shocked that they were kept in the dark to what is happening. We have something that is called the Arab Spring, and everybody, a lot of people actually in the beginning, now they are beginning to see that this spring really, it's not a spring. It's probably a fall and started as one, but we did not know. Now to me, spring, the word spring in Arabic, Rabia, and that's how they translate it in the Arabic language, as Arabia al-Arabi. If I was the translator, I would have actually translated it into, instead of Rabia Arabi, the spring, which is Zumbarak in Arabic. I don't know what it is in Persian, Zumbarak, spring. Do you know what it is? Okay. Well, you understand. So to me, what happened, you know, just like this spring that you push down, the more you push down, you're going to have more strength. You are packing that energy in. And then all you have to do is just take one little piece off, and all of a sudden it's going to actually come up with a force equal to the force that you pushed it down. Well, for over 40 years, they have done that with the Arab people. They had put and they installed governments on them that was oppressive government, that was there were governments that were basically held by the United States and Western powers in those offices. And when the time came to actually remove these governments, some people say, well, what happened is actually not good for Israel. And I tell people, if the United States is involved in something and the United States wants something, then you better stop and think about it. Because if the United States wants Gaddafi to be removed from power because somehow the Americans woke up one morning and they thought about their cousins, the Libyans, under oppression for 45 years, and they wanted to liberate them, and they are the Americans wanted to liberate them, or the French. No, I'm going to stop and say, wait a minute, what's in it for them? The United States is not going to go out there and liberate countries and liberate people and spend millions and billions of dollars just to liberate the Arabs from the oppressive regimes. Why? That's the question I want to ask. Are they worried about the Syrians, that the Syrian regime was somehow, it's like, oh, they're killing their people? Were they killing their people before you sent these people in? Before you sent the guns and the millions of dollars? Before you convinced the same people, by the way, the same people who were fighting in Afghanistan as Al-Qaeda, recruiters for Al-Qaeda who went and actually to war in Afghanistan, they recycled the same people. They went from fighting the United States so the United States can say, oh, we have Al-Qaeda fighting us in Afghanistan, to fighting for the United States in Libya. The same people, the same recruiters with their same guns. You know, there's a name, if any of you remember, if you know any of the leaders there in Tripoli, Bilhaj, one of them is Bilhaj. This guy was a recruiter for Al-Qaeda. Then all of a sudden he is a recruiter for the CIA with the same people. Okay, they're telling me I have 5 hours left. And so these same people, actually, they recycled them from one revolution to another revolution, and now they are in Syria, fighting in Syria. Now, regardless of how you feel about the Syrian regime, I never liked any of the Arab regimes. But regardless, if I know the power that is fighting there is the United States, then I'm going to stop and say, well, wait a minute. What's in it for the United States here? Well, the answer is really nothing. And it's actually against the national interest of the United States to do what it's doing. Then why the United States is doing this? Well, it happened that the misconception that we have actually in the Arab world, and it's probably in Iran too, that Israel is the United States puppy. Well, actually, it's the opposite that is true. The United States is Israel's puppet in the world. It's not the other way around. The United States does not rule Israel. It's Israel who rules the United States. And the proof for that, every one of our presidents, before they actually announce that they are going to run for president, they have to go to my land, Jerusalem, and go to the Wailing Wall, the supposedly Wailing Wall that the Jews say it's theirs. They have to go there and pray, get a stamped kosher on their behinds, and come back here to the United States to become presidents of the United States. That doesn't sound like the United States is the one running Israel. That sounds like Israel is the one running the United States. We all know all congressmen, if they want to be something, they have to go and get blessings from Israel. So, wait a minute. If the United States is doing this in the Arab world, and it's exactly according to the plan that they have wrote back in 1982, and they are implementing it, the first plan, strategies in the 1980s for Israel, the Clean Break document, and the third document, which is PNAC, the Project for the New American Century, which basically the United States gave themselves a license to kill, that if we think that somebody thinks they're going to harm us, we're going to kill them. Now, remember what I said. If we think, as Americans, if we think, not we know, If we think that they think, they don't even have to show us anything on the ground that they're going to harm us. If we think they think they're going to harm us, we're going to go and kill them. And that's exactly the lie that they had sold their people here about Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction. This is the same lie they are circulating now about Bashar al-Assad in Syria, that he's going to use chemical weapons and that he's killing his people. You know, it's like, you know, it's like these people who came from the outside to destroy this country, it's like they are throwing flowers and the regime is shooting bullets at them, because if you listen to Al Jazeera, you think everyone dying in Syria is just dying from the regime. Not these armies that they are sending in to Syria to actually finish off the last regime standing against Israel. And then they will have all Arab regimes under their control. And then they go into, you know, we don't need to talk about the Gulf countries, because they have been under control from day one. I know I probably went way over my time, but I appreciate you listening, and thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you, Doctor. It was a wonderful speech, and we all enjoyed it. Without any delay, I ask the panelists to please come on the podium. Hujjat al-Islam, Sayyid Ilya, please. Imam Asi, and Brother Afif. So inshallah, we open the floor for question and answer. You can either write your question down if you like, or you can ask them orally.
That's a good question, and actually that's one of the questions that people always ask me. It's like, look, they got rid of Mubarak and they put the Muslim Brotherhood there. Isn't that good? I say, no, that's not good. Now, I did kind of, because I knew the time, you know, we had an hour and then we had to chop it down to 30 minutes. The spring theory that I actually came up with is, once this spring came up, the pieces, which is the Arab countries, on top of this spring, it got thrown all over the place. And as you know, if you put anything on the spring and it comes up, it's going to fall, and you never know where it's going to fall. And you need somebody in there to actually put the pieces where they need to go. The people who planned this whole thing, they want this to go. Now, the one thing that they wanted right now is to divide the Arab countries into separate, and everyone in the beginning, they were telling us, look, they moved Mubarak, he's a dictator. I said, yeah, but look what's coming. What's coming is total chaos, and that's exactly what they want. Now, what is happening in Egypt, and Mark, you've been following what I have been saying for years, Egypt exactly fallen into, even though no United States fighters and jets had to go in there to remove Mubarak, but now Egypt is in total chaos. And if you read that document that I talked about, they exactly said what they're going to do in Egypt, and that's exactly what is happening. You have forces in Egypt, some of them they say they represent Islam. I have to actually question that sometimes. The problem with us Muslims is we are so emotional when it comes to the name Islam. So anyone, any party, any hizb that has Islam in it, it's like, oh, mashallah, we have to, you know, go with them. No, some people are using the name Islam, actually, because it sells. You know, Islam does sell in many of the Arab and Muslim countries. But Egypt is not, don't think Egypt is out of the game yet, because Egypt, the days that are coming, it's going to be horrible days for Egypt. And that's exactly what they wanted.
This is a very complex type of, it's actually a risk that the military establishments in the Middle East have bought into under the grand supervision of their of the establishments that trained them, whether it's Tunisia, whether it's Egypt, to a certain extent Yemen. And the risk in this is that you have to know that the people who are in these countries and the other countries there have been living not since World War I, but many probably centuries before that, knowing that they don't have a representative government. That's been internalized so deep and so concentrated in their subliminal selves that they would look at any opportunity to break loose from this centuries of political, the absence of political self-representation. And what is happening now is that there is an Islamic consolidation extending from Islamic Iran to the Mediterranean. And the purpose of that consolidation is one. This has been repeatedly said in the media and everywhere else, but in different languages and with different hues to it. The purpose of the Islamic Republic in Iran, as far as its foreign policy is concerned, is one. Anyone who's trying to think otherwise is off course. It's the liberation of Palestine. And that goal has been pursued with vigor and determination, even though the people who are suffering more from this are the Iranians and the Palestinians, both, in different ways. The United States government, the Israeli government, and their lackey extensions in the area, Saudi Arabia and the others, they are aware in different degrees of what's happening. So they're looking at this risk. We are going to have these people believe that they have self-representative government. Islam is the tag for all of this. Islam will fulfill that expectation. So if we can bring to the fore these types of Islamic parties that in a sense have a history of struggle, they do have some credibility among the Muslim masses. If we can bring them to the fore, but secure two things. Number one, they're not going to prioritize the liberation of Palestine. They're going to prioritize the folding up the Islamic effort from Iran back into the confines of the Iranian nation state. Iran should have no influence in Iraq, no influence in Syria, no influence in Lebanon. If we can get these types of Islam, quote-unquote, Islamic representatives to come along with this, then we are going to serve two purposes. We are going to derail Islamic self-determination in North Africa, Southwest Asia, in the Arab countries. We're going to derail that on one side. On the other side, we are going to put the Islamic Republic of Iran back into its national cage. You have nothing to do with Palestine. Stay out of it. The element here to pay close attention to is how far and to what extent these Islamic parties are going to understand this. And second of all, are they going to say, okay, now we know what the game is. We're going to outfox the fox. We are going to outsmart the Americans and Israelis, the American government, the Israeli officials. This is what we're going to do. If they think they're going to do that, minus, you know, a firm leadership, a reference point, which they don't have. I mean, anyone who looks at the developments in Egypt and other places realizes with the general and undefined intention to liberate Palestine, there is no a type of ideological reference point here. They don't have. Look at Iran and look at Egypt. When the Islamic Revolution in Iran took place, they wrote a constitution in the span of a few weeks. Right now, the Egyptians have been trying to write a constitution. It's taken them over 6 months, and they still haven't written a constitution. So there is an element here that some people, the smart people, don't underestimate the CIA, the Mossad, and all of these. they have their info. I wouldn't doubt someone here, somehow, somewhere, will convey some of these, you know, what's being said here to whomever they work for. But they're around, they try to take the pulse, they want this, they want the sense of where things are. And I'm by nature, I'm optimistic. I think the risk that the United States and the Israelis are taking is going to backfire on them very badly. In the interim, there's going to be a lot of strife and these types of things.
So if I understand what you're saying, fought and won in 1979, that Iran, that influence is going to go to these Arab countries and they're going to fight revolutions that fall along the same lines, and as such, you know, there will be order in these societies, and this order in these Arab countries would be absolutely detrimental to the continued existence of Israel. So what they, if I read what you're saying correctly, what they are doing is trying to head off this inevitable influence, Iranian influence over these Arab countries, and instead bring forth this this miscarriage of a revolution that they are controlling to keep the Iranians out. Is that what you're saying?
I would just add that all of these local Arabian regimes, in addition to their enablers in Tel Aviv and Washington, what they are concerned with, as far as Iran is concerned, is that there's an appeal to the Islamic Revolution of Iran because of its pursuit of the liberation of Palestine. They want to take that appeal away. And if they're going to use Islam against Islam, the Islam of the Arabians with its, you know, kowtowing to the United States and all of this, if that can be done, all the better. They're willing to go to that. And they don't care if they have a breeding of Saudi Arabias around. Egypt becomes another Saudi Arabia, and Tunisia becomes another Saudi Arabia, and whatever becomes another. Hey, if you guys, if you Muslims want to chop off your hands if someone steals, if you want to chop off the head in Chop Chop Square if someone commits a crime, I mean, we'll keep, you can have the penal law that you choose for yourselves. But look, we're concerned with the petroleum. We're concerned with the natural resources. We're concerned with cheap labor. We're concerned with the consumer market. And we are concerned with Israel before and after everything else. If you guys leave those things alone and you want to pursue a legalistic interpretation of Islam as far as your courts are concerned, well, you can have all the Saudi Arabias in the world that you want.
Okay, we'll have one more question from the audience, then I'll read, I got some of the questions here. Anybody has a question? Go ahead, sister.
Sorry, I don't remember your name. You were asking us, do we identify ourselves as Muslim Americans or American Muslims? I'm curious, why do you think that that's a relevant question? Because when we hyphenate, it's usually a nationality hyphenation, not a religious hyphenation. So I don't say I'm Muslim American or I'm American Muslim. I'm American or American Iranian. But Muslim is my religion. American is where I live. I don't hyphenate these things at all. So.
Well, the media does. Even if you don't hyphenate, the media does hyphenate. And
well, why feed into that?
I'm making a lot of racket here, but that's about it. I'll just get up here for less than a minute. My message was the media. I mean, there's a big difference when you say Muslim hyphen American, and they're using that against us, because if you go out there to the streets, what people think of Muslims, if you go to any classroom, and I did, by the way, I spoke at a fourth grade school, at a fourth grade in a school. And one of the little kids, when they knew I was a Muslim, come in to basically tell them about Islam. They came into the library and they were looking at me. And one of them, before we started, he goes, "Are you a terrorist?" That's exactly what happened. He asked me if I was a terrorist, and I was dressed up in a suit, by the way. I wasn't dressed up in a anything else. So, Muslim American. Now, what my message was, be a Muslim first, live like a Muslim. In this country, that you call home. They're not giving us. We want...
You're a terrorist or not? Would that have solved the question?
So, no, I think you're not. I think I'm having problem getting the message to you of the difference between Muslim Americans and American Muslims.
No, I'm questioning why you have to have either existing.
Well,
why
unfortunately, it's not
label?
Your choice. It's not your
it
choice.
Absolutely, it is.
Well, it's not. When you have $1 billion media or billions-dollar media that is labeling you as a terrorist, I guarantee you, you go into a Walmart or Kmart, people are going to look at you like she looks like a terrorist. That's the stereotype that we need to start changing instead of living. That's my message. That's, yes, we do have a label. I don't want that label.
But if I go into a Walmart and they say, you look like a terrorist, am I supposed to say, no, I'm an American Muslim, so therefore I'm not a terrorist? Is that the conclusion?
No, I want Muslims to be in America known just like anyone else and be effective in the United States as Muslims, as a power, just like the Jewish power is.
And they don't call themselves Jewish American, do they?
They don't?
They're just Jewish.
Really? Well, you know, they did not before, but right now they are in your face, on TV, in the movies, everywhere. And right now, many of these actors, they identify themselves as Jewish, and they're not, because that's where the power is. Now, we want Muslims to be in this country having that kind of power. That's the message. The message is, it's not good to feel we are excluded. It's not good to feel that, yeah, I do look like a terrorist. No. I am here, and I'm going to be a power one of these days in this United States that we call the Great Satan.
Well, inshallah, we have questions, and we'll go to our topic of Wilayat al-Fakhina. The first question from the audience is, what does Wilayat al-Fakhina mean, and what is the basis of Wilayat al-Fakhina in Islam?
Assalamu alaikum. I think that the question was, what is Wilayat al-Faqih and what is its basis insofar as Islam is concerned? Wilayat al-Faqih is one blueprint for an Islamic government in the modern world. It doesn't lay out all of the mechanisms of a state. It just provides an ideological basis for what an Islamic government ought to look like and who its executives ought to be in a modern Islamic state or an Islamic government. The basis of it basically is a set of ayat from the Quran, where Allah Ta'ala says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَأْمُرُكُمْ أَن تُؤَدُّوا الْأَمَانَاتِ إِلَىٰ أَهْلِهَا وَإِذَا حَكَمْتُمْ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ أَن تَحْكُمُوا بِالْعَدْلِ. That Allah Ta'ala commands you to render your civic trust to its capable executors. And of course, the civic trust here is the trust of rule or the trust of governance. And that ought to be rendered to the people who demonstrate the capacity to socialize Allah's command and counsel into the society in general, to be able to adjudicate issues amongst the people with impartiality, justice, and equity, and if need be, to have the capacity to use the original Islamic sources, which is the Quran and the Sunnah, to be able to create temporal legislation as the needs for it arise for a particular time and place. Insofar as laying out this particular blueprint, Imam Khomeini departed from traditional Shi'i political thought in over the last 200 or 300 years in developing this sort of ideological blueprint for an Islamic government. As he began to develop the idea started basically with a rejection before it started with an affirmation. If you read his lectures related to Wilayat al-Faqih, he counsels the Islamic fuqaha, which would be the executors of an Islamic government, because they have demonstrated the capacity to be able to make decisions in an Islamic society according to the reference points of the Quran and the Sunnah. He counseled them that they can never use sources other than the Quran and the Sunnah in order to translate moral imperatives into a legal code, into a code of governance. That as far as translating the moral code into a legal system and into mechanisms of state, all the information that they need is contained in the Quran and the Sunnah, and thereby they don't have to borrow from Western penal codes or representative mechanisms or what you might consider to be democracies, theocracies, nationalisms, or whatever else is associated with a particular historical experience that does not apply to Muslims. And so I guess in a nutshell, I hope that, you know, answered the question. I think the panelists may have something to add to that.
You know, there are many ways of answering questions. This is going to be my way. These are two words, wilaya and faqih. Wilaya is, for those of you who may have a little familiarity with the with the Arabic language, there are words that gain their synonymous meaning by the context that they are in. And this is one of those words. It depends on where you use it and in which context, the paragraph or the page, etc. It can be traced to allegiance, alliance, authority, and governorship. That is wilaya. Then the word faqih is basically a credible Islamic scholar who has the qualifications to understand and interpret the meanings of the Quran and the Hadith. So what's being said here by the combination of these two words is that wilayat al-faqih, there is a responsibility of wilaya due upon the faqih. There's a responsibility of authority and governorship that is part and parcel of the character and the duties of the faqih. In other words, the imam, may Allah bless his soul, was saying that the religious scholars of Islam should step out of the solely scholastic description that they have and assume the positions of power and authority in society. It's like the expression that's used most frequently is the separation of church and state. This is, I think, so everyone knows what someone says. Oh, we believe in the separation of church and state. Wilayat al-faqih is the combination of scholar with politics. And politics is not with the negative connotation of the word. It's the moral politics that are due in a clean society. So that's what is meant by wilayat al-faqih.
Well, we have a second full question. This is for Hujjatul Islam, Sayyid Abbas, the concept of governance of Islam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Islam is a religion which is sent by Allah. And throughout the passage of human history, all the prophets and messengers in our belief system were subservient towards the Creator, were submitting to Allah, and were Muslims. Islam actually means submission to God. So we believe that Abraham was a Muslim, Jesus was a Muslim, Moses was a Muslim, Noah was a Muslim, and all of them were Muslims. So it's nothing new for Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon all of them. Sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. And this religion which Allah has and He has sent on His prophets, He sent it not to be shelved or archived. He sent it to be enforced and implemented. The social justice system of the Holy Quran, which is meant to ensure that every human being, regardless of his faith, gets what he deserves to get. So Islam is supposed to rule, and the meaning of Islamic rule means that we want to lead a life according to how our Creator has said. And in Islamic ideology, obviously, it's the entire ideology is based on Islamic world view. How we say in Farsi, Jahan Biniye Islami, the Islamic worldview. And Islamic worldview believes that Islam is a religion connected to the society, ijtima, and it is there to be enforced and implemented. And in order for the religion to be enforced, you require a government. You can never enforce the law and the justice that every human is thirsty to get by nature. You cannot expect the justice to be implemented by itself. No law can enforce its own self. So the lawmaker, the highest experts of the law, Islam says, the highest experts of the law have the right to enforce the law. And this is what we call the faqih. So in Islamic world view, there is no room for a person to think for a second that the religion is not there to be enforced. Obviously, that doesn't mean that we are forcing our ideology on people and forcing them to turn to Islam, like it's misinterpreted by some. It's never was like this, and it is not. And no prophet, our Holy Prophet, never converted anybody forcibly towards Islam. Instead, he converted people with his morals. So Islam is sent to be enforced in the society so that the social justice system is given to every human being. And every human being gets the justice. Now, obviously, Islam and the politics is one and the same thing. Again, like Imam Asi was saying, with politics, what we mean is the divine social justice system based on the divine justice. That means it's the justful system that Islam wants to implement in the whole society. So you cannot expect the religion without the government. And obviously that's a notion that you find in non-Islamic societies. In the Christian community, say the church and state are separate. In our religion, the masjid and the government is never separate, and it cannot be separate. So the hadith Sun Mubarak says, al-Islamu was-sultanu tawamane. Islam and the government are twins. Fal-Islamu ussun was-sultanu haris. So Islam is the foundation, and the government is the guard. فَمَا لَا أُسَّ لَهُ يُهْدَمْ وَمَا لَا حَارَسَ لَهُ ضَائِعْ. So anything that doesn't have a foundation falls down and collapses. And anything that doesn't have a guard will get wasted. So Islam is unthinkable to survive without a government. And this is what we find since centuries after the Holy Prophet, Muslims have been subjected to these types of oppressive kingdoms and dynasties, who these rulers, and in today's world we find all these 57 Muslim countries. You keep the Islamic Republic aside and keep the Syrian government, who is opposing the Zionist regime, isn't it right, aside, and you find almost every other Islamic government in the Islamic world is either subservient towards the atrocities of the Zionist regime towards the innocent civilians in Palestine and elsewhere, and or they are silent towards the atrocities of the Zionists. So we find that these, because these puppet governments have been either installed or supported by those imperialists, you know, and supported by the imperialist governments, and they were never practicing Islam to begin with. So Islam is a religion which cannot survive in its pure form without the government. This is what has been in our contemporary times revived by Imam al-Khomeini, radwanullah alayh, isn't it right? So you find that the pure religion has to be enforced by the highest level experts of that religion, who are practicing the values and principles of the same religion in their personal lives in the best form, isn't it right? So they are not misusing the government for their worldly interests. So the government is not influencing them or corrupting them. Instead, they are the ones who are influencing the government with the justice that they install on their spirituality. They're installing the same justice on the rest of the people in the society. So that's the whole concept. It has been enforced by, that's why we believe, rightfully so, you know, like my teacher Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli Hafizahullah always says, that in Islam we don't believe in the walayat of faqih in the real sense. Actually, we believe in the walayatul fiqh wal adl. We believe in the real sense, the government of fiqh, means the Islamic, pure Islamic jurisprudence and the pure Islamic law, and wal adl, and the justice. So we want the Islamic law of God and the justice to be ruling over us, not any worldly desires of people who are corrupted by power to come up and rule over us, because we believe in God. So in Islam, we have the government of Islamic jurisprudence and the government of justice. And that's why we need an expert who is faqih, he's in-depth in his knowledge, he has tafaqquh fi deen, the in-depth understanding of the religion itself, so he may not commit a sin because of unknowing the law. Plus, the faqih has to be adil, just in his behavior, so he may not commit a sin knowingly. So his faqahat is a dalil that he cannot commit a wrong unknowingly, because he's a faqih, he's a knowledgeable person. And his adalat and justice is a dalil that he will not commit a sin knowingly. So this is how a believer has to follow the most knowledgeable person about the Islamic jurisprudence, who is the most pious as well.
Thank you, brother. Next question will be from the audience. Let's give a chance to the sister. Go ahead, sister.
Alhamdulillah, we have several nowadays, and if you can read the book which is named Wilayat-e Faqih of Ayatollah Jawadi Hafizahullah, is very good. He has another book, Wilayat Dar Quran, which is also very, very informative, and also, the book of Shaheed Mutahhari is also very nice to clear up the concepts of Islam, Imamat wa Rahbari. It's very nice to clear up the concepts of Islam about the walayat. And likewise, I think it's also good to read the book which is... there is another book written by Imam Baqir al-Sadr, Ayatullah al-Uzma, Imam Baqir al-Sadr, rahmatullah alayh, where he says, Al-Islam Yaqudul Hayat. That's the name of his book, Islam Rules the Life. This is one of the most favorite books of mine. And here he obviously talks about the concept, the rock bottom concept in Islam, and based on the teachings of the Prophet and teachings of the Holy Quran, that what Islam is all about, what in the world is Islam expecting from us, the believers, and our leaders to do. So Al-Islam Yaqud al-Hayat is very good for you to understand the concept of leadership in Islam. Books in English, honestly, I am not updated about which of the books have been translated yet. Most of the books that I mentioned are all in Farsi. Some of them, like the last one, is in Arabic. I expect you can find the book Imamat and Rahbari of Shahid Mutahari already translated in English. And I am honestly not updated which of the books that I mentioned have been translated. Lots of books are being translated in Islamic Iran. And you can find, I think, the largest collection on ansariyan.net. So you can browse on their website and get the whole list and find out if these names that I mentioned are there. Probably Ansariyan.net has the largest collection of English translated books.
There's one book in English that's very good. It's called Islam and Revolution. And I think Wilayat al-Faqih, as we have it right now, it's a series of lectures that Imam Khomeini gave on the topic. And so while he didn't compile his lectures in the form of a book, some of his students did. And so one of these books was translated, is called Islam and Revolution, and so it has that original series of lectures that he gave on the topic, in addition to a wide-ranging set of speeches that preceded his return to Islamic Iran in 1979. The author is Imam Khomeini, but it was translated by Professor Hamid Agar at Berkeley.
By the way, there's another book. It's not exactly on this topic, even though this topic is part of the book. And it explains the convergence of thought as far as assuming political responsibilities by Islamic scholars who are qualified to do so in both the Sunni context and the Shi'i context. That book was written by the late Dr. Kalim Siddiqui. There's the word convergence in its title. I can't remember the exact title of it, but someone I think who can Google Dr. Kalim Siddiqui can find out the name of that book. It's a very valuable contribution to understanding the resistance in the Sunni school of thought and in the Shi'i school of thought to the concept of Wilayat al-Faqih. And it also brings out the those who support the Islamic scholars assuming these types of positions from both the Sunni school of thought and the Shi'i school of thought, and how they at the end converged in Imam Khomeini's revolution. Yeah, I think it's called The Convergence of Political Thought in Islam. Brother Afif reminded me of the title.
Okay, next question, Brother Hamid, followed by Brother Mark. Brother Hamid, no, you first.
What's the difference between the Velayat of Imam and Velayat al-Faqih, Imam in Velayat al-Kubra, inshallah, if you can explain. And I want to know in what date or what, I mean, era was the Velayat al-Faqih was known as the Velayat al-Faqih?
Well, Velayat is not a new concept for anyone who believes in the Holy Quran, because Allah says, فَاللَّهُ هُوَ الْوَلِيِّ. And this تَقْدِيمُ مَا حَقُّهُ التَّأْخِيرُ يُفِيدُ الْحَصَرُ. So this is inhisarul walaya. This is restricting the walayat. Walaya in Arabic means, if you put the fatha, zabar fatha on top of the waw, it means al-hukuma. If you put the kasra under the waw, al-wilaya, it means al-hub wal-mahabba, love. Wilaya means mahabbat. Walaya means hukumat. And they are both derived from the actual Arabic word of al-wal-yu, waw and lam and ya, which means al-qurb. Kul mimma yalika. In Arabic they say, eat from what is next to you, close to you. So kul mimma yakrubuka. So wali means qareeb, actually, in the literal sense of the word. So basically all the authorities that the hakim has is because of his qurb and closeness, so towards Allah and towards the hujjat of the time. So the point is that walayat is a Quranic concept. Quran has said, innama waliyukum Allahu wa rasuluhu walladhina amanu alladhina yuqimuna as-salata wa yu'tuna az-zakata wa hum raki'un. So walayat is in Quran. So the concept is already a Quranic concept. Prophet established the first government in his time. Medina was the capital of his Islamic government, first Islamic government. So we have the concept already. We have the enforcement of the concept done by the Holy Prophet. Now, even in the times of Ahlul Bayt, you find Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he appointed, you know, Malik al-Ashtar to be the Wali of Egypt. So it's not something which is in the time of the Ghaybatul Imam, where the Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam is in the occultation. You know, even in the time where we have in the Hudurul A'imma, when they were present, we find Malik al-Ashtar was appointed to be the Wali, means the governor, from the same root word of walayat. So even in the lifetime of Ahlul Bayt, they have been appointing people whom they trusted to do the job of governance for those areas. So walayat was a concept which has been there since the time of the Prophet, since the time of Ahlul Bayt. It's in the Asr al-Tashri', how we say, the time of the legislation of Islamic Sharia. It has been there, and it, you know, obviously, like I said earlier, we find since centuries the Muslim Ummah have been subjected to these mulukiyat and kingdoms and oppressive rulers who have practically nothing to do with Islamic practice, and they have been earning a bad name for the religion. So we did not have the proper rulers. In this time we happen to have a adil faqih coming forward. He cares about the mustad'afin. I remember Imam al-Khomeini, you know, instead of talking like Shia and Sunni, he used to talk about mustad'afin. You know, all the mustad'af people of the world, regardless of their faith. Even if a Jew is oppressed somewhere, we care about it. We care about all the humans. So Islamic concept of justice is a widespread concept that will not only take care of all the Muslims, but take care of all the humans. So obviously it has been there throughout the history. Our fuqaha, you turn to their books written by Sheikh al-Mufid, Sheikh al-Tusi, in his, you know, he talks about in Kitab al-Mabsut, first detailed book of our Islamic jurisprudence written in the history in 10 volumes. Sheikh al-Tusi, Sheikh Abu Ja'far, he's the founder of the Hawza of Najaf. So you found and you look in the books of Sheikh al-Ansari, Mullah Naraqi, Sahib al-Jawahir. So these fuqaha have been mentioning about the walayat of faqih, and you find the elaborate discussions available. So it has been a concept. The answer to your question is that it's not a new concept. It has been reaching our ears because of an Islamic government taking place. So lots of people haven't heard about that. Now we have Islamic government and there's a media. Now it is propagated. But it has been a Quranic concept enforced by the Prophet.
Yes, sorry. You were just talking about the marriage between church and state. And I guess, Imam Al-Asi, this is a question that I'll pose to you. When you look at Iran, you look at her bearing in the world, her demeanor in the world, and the manner that she's very rational, she's very reasonable, and since we know that it is the goal of these evildoers to keep this wall between church and state, okay, so that people are blind and running around and they have no bearing on anything. Is it the fact that the Islamic revolution, that they were able to marry church and state in this very balanced way that is such a threat to the Western powers, because the Western powers, they want to project the idea that you can't have church and state. You'll never be free people if the theologians are running things. Is it because the Iranians managed to put these things together in a balanced marriage that leads to this fury to destroy Iran the way that we see?
Yes, that's true. That's true. They managed to balance it very articulately and properly. And as a matter of fact, this is how Islam was. Prophet is the most knowledgeable person. Our holy prophet is the most knowledgeable person. And he has the right to rule according to Islam. Prophet Moses, when he was alive, he had the right to rule according to the Islamic teachings. Prophet Jesus, when he was there, he had the right of rule. When he was available on earth, he had the right to rule. So in our Islamic teachings, every prophet, every messenger of that time, who is the most superior one present, has the right to rule. So the bottom line is that the most knowledgeable person about the law of God, plus the one who practices the religion better than others, has the right to rule, so he doesn't get corrupted. He has no wrongdoing in terms of the ignorance towards the law, and he has no wrongdoing in terms of his practices because of his spiritual justice that he has enforced on himself. So he has the right to enforce justice and invite others towards justice. Now, when it comes to church and state being separate in the Christian community, we do witness that obviously, Bible has been altered and it does not survive in the original form. And in some cases, we find there are people who review Bible every 4 years. There are more than 40 versions of the Bible that we can see in the market. So obviously, teachings of Prophet Jesus were not protected by those who claimed that we follow him. So, and why the teachings were not protected? Because there were influential lobbies, authorities, or governments who did not want to give up the pleasures of the temporary world, which all the prophets propagated for the same divine agenda. And now we find that church was, the divine teachings were gone. The divine value system was not maintained. It became impure, not in the original form. Now when the divine teachings are not kept in the original form, obviously, these kinds of teachings, when they are not in the original form, they are not capable to run the government. Well, the reason why they were not allowed to run the government was not this. Actually, the statesmen and the politicians overpowered the religious people. And we find that, as a matter of fact, the statesmen and the politicians influenced the religious people and made them to be subservient. So as a matter of fact, church was never separated in the Christian world from the state. Church was made to be subservient to the statesmen. So you find in so many of the evangelical churches, Israeli flags are flying there. If it's a church is separate from the from the state, then why are you flying the Israeli flag? So it is not separated, it's subservient to the politics of the politicians. And you find some of the leaders of some of the denominations openly supporting the politics of the politicians, which is not morally correct. So basically, church was made to be subservient towards the state instead of making it separate. It was not separate,
if the religious people were powerful and strong enough, they would have first of all managed to keep the teachings and values in the pure form without being getting under pressure from the influential lobbies or authorities or governments to change the books and the values and principles. Second of all, they would have resisted in front of the inhumane and unethical policies of the politicians and maintain their independence. In that case, they would have the right to rule according to the pure law. But that never happened, so obviously the statesmen overpowered them, and now they are made to be subservient. So you can hardly find denominations who can raise their voice against the oppressions. Most of them don't do that.
Let me add something to that to give it a larger context. What Maulana Ilya just expressed also applies to a certain extent to the Muslims. The Christians are not alone in what happened to the church, because Muslims also have suffered from the same consequences. It all has to do with morality and power. There comes a time after Jesus, after Muhammad, after Moses, there comes a time in these generations that follow in which the moral character of society begins to lose ground vis-a-vis the political power grabbers in society. This begins to happen, and as this happens, and we all share human nature, whether we're Christians or Muslims, we all have this human nature. And when we see that, you know, the power has been now allocated to a certain class of people, and the religious components of that society, whether it's the church or whether it is, you know, certain Islamic scholarly classes, etc., they see that, wait a minute, this thing is way beyond us now. We can't reverse the tide. It's just too tremendous. So how are we going to deal with this? Some people sought to say, well, let's separate church from politics. You know, let's separate, you know. So everyone goes their happy way, and they're sort of relaxed with that. Meantime, when this is dealt with in such a fashion, everyone else in society suffers. We have the consequences right now that are snowballing against us in the form of, you know, unemployment, in the form of wars that are taking place, in the form of the discrimination that's going on. There's a lot of things that just have broken loose, and they're leading us very quickly to a type of a redress that should have taken place, you know, many years ago. One of the components in Shia'i Islam is that this did not happen in a similar way. There was a lot of resistance to this error between the moral component of society and the political class in society. There was a resistance, and that resistance culminated in the heroic stand of Imam Hussein, who is the grandson, great-grandson of the Prophet, against the second king in Islamic history. It culminated in that, and that that position, that heroic defiance of those who were in power. Imam Hussein didn't have anything. It was just like Jesus when they wanted to take him to the cross. What did Jesus have? He didn't have anything. But he had God on his side, and that was enough. And we have our little different interpretations of how that ended, or in our sense, it never ended, because Jesus was never crucified. But anyways, we get into theological issues here. The main point is, when Imam Hussein took this stand against the tyrannical ruling class, this heroic and selfless stand lived on, and it's supposed to have been the responsibility of those Shias, and I use this word knowing that there's different definitions to it, that the Shias should also honor this by themselves becoming replicates of Imam Hussein and being able to speak truth to power. But once again, when you go back to human nature and you see all this power, and I'm just a little individual over here, what am I going to say? What am I going to do? Forget it. And this is the type of thing that it draws us into either a passivity or rationalization of the status quo or subjugation to the powers that be and all these other things, and whereby our moral character dictates upon us to take a position for justice. And if that means I'm going to have to speak truth to power, regardless of what the consequences are going to be, crucifixion or the death on the plains of Karbala or whatever, if that's going to be the result, that's what you and I and everyone has to do. But that sort of got lost because of this gradual slipping that we are complicit. We, I don't mean you and me personally, but generally speaking, Muslims and Christians have been part of in this unfolding of history until we find ourselves where we are today.
Can
I just 1 minute on that? Mark, you mentioned actually the marriage of church and state, which actually gives the impression that you are talking about two separate, because marriage is between two that you unite together. In Islam, Islam is a way of life. It's a complete system. It's not just a religion where you worship God, but also it's a way of life. And if Islam is the on top of the society, then everything in Islam falls down as far as governors, as far as day-to-day dealings with people. If it's a Muslim society, then Islam has talked about every thing that has to do with the society from A to Z. So you cannot have a totally Islamic system without it being one. So it's only one, not two. It's not like you marry in church and state or the government. Islam is the government and the way of life for people.
Thank you, brother. We only have 1 minute to close this program, and I'll only, in 1 minute, I'll try to summarize. We heard that the Western slogan is that the democracy does not get along with faith and theocracy. In West, for a very long time, the church was separated from the state. That is, separation of religion and politics. Lo and behold, an imam, a man of faith, rose up and successfully challenged not only their false concept of democracy, but at the same time had a plan and a strategy and introduced Islamic democracy in the form of Islamic government. And the most important achievement of our honorable imam was to bring the long lost Abrahamic faith back to the central stage, revive the facts of true Islam, and wave the flag of justice in the whole world, raising the Islamic awakening and Islamic self-determination. Despite all hostilities, the chains of slavery, bondage, and servitude to taghuts were torn. Imam Rahmatullah Ta'ala Alayhi preached and showed in his actions the call of the grandson of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Hussein Alayhi Salam. Kullu yawmin Ashura, kullu arzin Karbala. Every day is Ashura, and every place is Karbala. That servitude is none for none but Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala alone. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen.